From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. We're just 1 month away from the consequential U.S. Senate runoff in Georgia. The election will determine whether Republicans continue to control the Senate. Tomorrow, President Trump and Vice President Mike Pence are expected to campaign in the Peach State for incumbent Republican Senators Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue. Meanwhile, the rift in the GOP seems to be growing deeper. Some Republicans are calling for their fellow GOP voters to sit out the runoff. They claim the election counting process in November was rigged, even though there is no evidence of that. Here's a pro-Trump trial lawyer, Lynn Wood, at a rally in Atlanta earlier this week.
Do not be fooled twice. This is Georgia. We ain't dumb. We're not going to go vote on January 5th in another machine made by China.
Former Republican House Speaker Newt Gingrich told Politico that Wood was, quote, destructive, and that every Georgia conservative who cares about America must vote in the runoff. Stephen Fowler is watching all of this unfold. He's a politics reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Lisa.
So there is a lot going on here. We know President Trump is not happy at all with Georgia's Republican Governor Brian Kemp, nor the Secretary of State, both of whom said that there was no widespread fraud in last month's presidential election. Is there evidence now that Trump and his allies' unfounded claims of fraud are backfiring on the GOP?
Well, absolutely. I spent 8 hours in a hearing yesterday where the president's attorney, Rudy Giuliani, was presenting evidence of why the state legislature should overthrow the election results and appoint their own electors for President Trump. And we had Republican state lawmakers expressing grave concern about these allegations of fraud that the courts have not yet decided are true, but they themselves think are true. And there are a lot of people that are worried that President Trump has said, don't vote absentee by mail. And now they're saying, don't vote by the voting machines either. And those are the only ways to vote in Georgia. So many people might end up sitting it out if they don't trust this system.
And does it seem as though their cautionary notes are taking heed? Do polls show anything in particular about how Republicans are treating those claims?
Well, the only thing we know for certain is that Georgia's two Senate runoffs are going to be tight. Every single vote is going to count. The brief polls that have come out have shown a tight race within the margin of error for both races. And really, it's just going to come down to who can get motivated out. And so with President Trump coming tomorrow and Vice President Pence here today, they're hoping that they can juice enough of the base and convince them to vote in this election, even though there's also pushing claims that the election's rigged.
Stephen Fowler, politics reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting, which will air a debate between Senators Kelly Loeffler and Democrat Raphael Warnock this Sunday, which you can see online. Thank you, Stephen.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, now to California, where millions of people will likely soon be subject to strict new stay-at-home orders. Here's Governor Gavin Newsom making his case yesterday.
The bottom line is if we don't act now, our hospital system will be overwhelmed. If we don't act now, we'll continue to see a death rate climb, more lives lost.
Nicole Nixon is politics reporter for Cap Radio in Sacramento. And Nicole, COVID surging in California like it is across the country, averaging 15,000 new cases a day there, triple the rate last month. What's the governor's plan?
Yeah, the plan is to tie these new regional stay-at-home orders to ICU capacity. So counties are being grouped into five regions across the state. And when that region has only 15% of its ICU beds left, that area will have to implement these new restrictions. That will mean a lot of businesses, including hair and nail salons, you know, museums, movie theaters, wineries, and bars will have to close. Restaurants will have to go takeout only, and some retail stores can stay open with limited capacity and mask requirements.
How close are some of the state's hospitals to reaching that threshold?
Yeah, it's getting really close. I mean, health officials expect it to only get worse because we still haven't seen this impact from Thanksgiving. In Northern California, these are mostly rural counties. They're already at 18% capacity. So it's very likely that we'll see this order start to take effect in some areas in the coming days.
And what are you hearing from businesses? This has got to be very tough for them heading into the holiday season.
Absolutely. And businesses have already been through so much this year. I got an email from the president of a nearby local chamber of commerce yesterday. He was really encouraging people to do any holiday shopping locally this year and support those small businesses, even if it means waiting in line to get into a store. He said that another stay-at-home order right now is just a great Christmas present for companies like Amazon and its shareholders.
Hmm. All right. Nicole Nixon, politics reporter for Cap Radio in Sacramento. Thanks for your time.
Thanks.
Well, California is one of several Western states adding an extra layer of scientific review to any COVID-19 vaccine that's approved by the FDA. Let's take a deeper look at that with Dr. Arthur Reingold. He leads California's Independent Vaccine Review Committee. He's also head of epidemiology at the UC Berkeley School of Public Health. He's on Skype. Doctor, nice to speak with you.
Nice to speak with you.
And you're reviewing vaccine data at the same time as the FDA. Do you have any concerns at this point about the safety?
Well, so far, based on the phase one and phase two data that we've seen for at least the Moderna and the Pfizer trials, I would say the safety does not look like it's going to be a problem.
Can you explain how these individual state work groups function and if there's any chance that you'd come to a different conclusion than the FDA?
Well, we certainly hope we're not going to come to a different conclusion. And the reality is we'll be looking at more or less the same data that the FDA and the ACIP of the CDC have looked at. You know, the purpose of having this done here in California and potentially in other states is primarily so that anyone who has concerns about federal processes under the current administration, we hope will be reassured if an independent group of experts here in California comes to a similar conclusion.
Yeah. And to that point, Doctor, these state advisory panels first emerge when there was some concern that the FDA process to approve the vaccines had been corrupted by politics, that they would be rushed to approval before the election. But at this point, the election is over. There's a new administration coming in. Do you think that that concern is mostly passed?
Well, I think the concern has largely passed, but I think it's left a residual in many people's minds about the extent to which they might be able to trust federal groups at the moment. I personally have full confidence in the FDA and the CDC, but I could understand if there's some residual concern. And of course, this week we've seen, and last week as well, potentially pressure from the White House on the FDA to speed up the process because otherwise the British might beat us. I don't think that kind of pressure is helpful, frankly.
Yeah. Will this extra layer of review in California delay the deployment of vaccines in your state?
Well, that's the other concern that people have raised. We expect to have the relevant data basically within 24 hours of when the ACIP does. So I don't expect there to be any appreciable delay between when CDC and FDA weigh in and when we weigh in.
The ACIP panel that you're referring to there, the CDC advisory panel that voted on how vaccines should be distributed, there was one doctor on that panel who had some concern that the vaccine has not been tested in people living in nursing homes or long-term care facilities, and yet those will be the first people, among the first people in line to get those shots. Do you worry about that?
Well, I think the concern that she raised is that, first of all, we won't know very much about the safety or the efficacy of the vaccine in this very fragile and high-risk group. But I think many people, including myself, believe that they're at such high risk of COVID, and there's really no reason to think that the adverse events are going to be substantially different, that personally, if I were still on the ACIP, which I'm not, I probably would have voted with the 14 majority rather than with the one minority member.
Hmm. As soon as that green light appears, your state and all 50 states will have a big logistical challenge ahead of them, but maybe no more so than in California, where 40 million people live approximately. To the best of your understanding, how will the distribution be carried out in California?
Well, like all states, California has been planning this for a while. California, unlike some states, because of its size, has to worry about basically doing this through 58 counties and actually three city health departments. At the end of the day, the counties, together with their medical partners, the pharmacies, the medical schools, the hospitals, will have to implement. So the state of California is providing guidance. But Los Angeles might do something slightly different than San Francisco, which might do something different from a small rural county.
Are you confident that it will go smoothly? Do you see any pain points?
Well, I think the main concerns are, first of all, because of the cold chain requirements for these vaccines. It's going to be a challenge to get it to rural areas or to areas that are further away from, you know, large deep freezes. And of course, fundamentally, when the first doses arrive, hopefully in a few weeks. There won't be enough for everyone, even in the highest tier groups. So there's going to have to be basically some priority setting, even within those very high tier groups, while we await more doses.
Dr. Arthur Reingold, chair of California's COVID-19 Scientific Safety Review Workgroup and the head of epidemiology at the UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Thank you, doctor.
Thank you.
Applications for degrees in healthcare are on the rise during the pandemic. The Association of American Medical Colleges has seen applications to med schools up 18% this year over last, and nursing programs across the country are seeing something similar. Donna Glenn is at Regis College in Weston, Massachusetts. She's associate dean and professor of nursing. Donna, welcome. Good to speak with you.
Thank you for having me today.
Sure. And what kind of added interest have you seen in applications for your nursing program?
So at Regis College, we have the traditional undergraduate nurses that obtain their bachelor's degree. Those numbers have remained steady. We've seen the biggest increase in our accelerated nursing programs. These are programs for individuals who hold a bachelor's degree in a non-nursing discipline and have made the decision during a pandemic to come back to school to earn a bachelor's degree in nursing and enter the healthcare workforce.
Well, that's interesting. Now, the fact that it's accelerated, does that say to you that they want to get in there as quickly as possible?
Absolutely. They do want to get in. And since they already have a previous bachelor's degree, they've already done those core requirements. So in 16 months full time, they're able to then enter as a bachelor's prepared RN into the healthcare system where we are desperate right now for nurses.
Well, and I wonder if part of it is people feeling called into service. A member of the Association of American Medical Colleges compared the increase in applications to the increase in people joining the military after 9/11.
Correct. And it's interesting because I was a very young nurse at the HIV crisis when that hit. And we saw the opposite. We saw people leaving nursing, leaving medical schools. And now there's an increased sense of responsibility and caring, I believe, for the population at large, which I am thrilled that the nurses of the future are committed to such high acuity patient care.
What do you think the difference is between those two crises?
I think there's several aspects that have caused this. I think one is economic and financial. Nursing is a solid profession that can even withstand a pandemic. So I think a lot of people have been displaced from other professions and now want to serve and have the opportunity. And nursing is one of those professions that there are so many opportunities within nursing. Acute care hospitals, community care, behavioral health, pediatrics. So it really opens up a wide range of opportunities.
Well, and right, we see the U.S. economy is still down by about 10 million jobs since the pandemic started. Are you seeing applications from people who maybe are freshly out of work and looking for a new start?
Absolutely. For our accelerated programs, we have a fall and spring start, and we've seen a 40% increase in applications.
Wow. So by the time these students graduate, even in an accelerated program, we hope that the pandemic will be over. Either way,
we
do. It's reminded us how but it's reminded us how dangerous the work is, even if it is over. Do you think that people who are applying now understand the challenges of this job? Are they realistic about it?
If they're not when they start our program, they're very aware when they end our program. We take the time to educate the nurses in the risk associated with nursing. And even pre-pandemic, there were risks associated with nursing. Violence against nurses is on the rise nationally. So we at Regis make the point of educating our nurses so that they are safe practitioners when they enter professional nursing.
Even before the pandemic, it was difficult. It was tough to get admitted into a nursing program. And now with so many more applications, it's got to be even tougher. Is your school trying to ramp up capacity or deal with that issue?
Well, ramping up capacity is challenging because we have to get that approved. Every state has a board of registration of nursing. So when you want to increase your enrollment, you have to be approved by the board of registration of nursing. And plus, we have to ensure that there are clinical sites available for our nursing students. So it's a multi-step puzzle that with a lot of moving pieces as far as hiring clinical faculty, hiring classroom faculty, ensuring that there are clinical sites available. So it's challenging, but we're meeting that challenge.
Okay, to that point of finding clinical sites, are you putting nursing students in COVID wards or in hospitals where there's a huge number of infections? How are you handling that?
Well, we're not sending nursing students to COVID-designated units. And that was a decision made by the deans of the colleges of nursing in Massachusetts and the chief nursing officers of the hospital. And the decision was really based on available PPE. We didn't want the student nurses going through twice the amount of PPE in caring for the patients. So that's how that decision was made. But now with the increased numbers, we're seeing many patients testing positive, and many of these are showing no symptoms. So the nursing students are caring for COVID patients, but not on the COVID unit.
Donna Glenn, Associate Dean and Professor of Nursing at Regis College in Weston, Massachusetts. Thank you for joining us, and thanks for the work you're doing.
Thank you.
And let's hear what a nursing student thinks about all this. Tanya Sannon is a senior at Villanova's Fitzpatrick College of Nursing. Tanya, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, sure. And what a time to become a nurse. Why have you signed up for this?
I signed up to, well, to put it how you said, I signed up to be a nursing student junior year of high school. So didn't know this would happen, you know, my senior year when I'm about to go into the real world. But I decided to become a nurse because I wanted to be at the bedside and be taking care of people and patients when they're at their worst.
Well, you're going to get the chance to do that soon. And I wonder if you feel some kind of anticipation watching from the sidelines. You see what's happening to nurses on the front lines. They're putting their health at risk. Some are getting sick. Sometimes they're dying. And at the very least, they're suffering tremendous amounts of burnout. What's it like to watch that happen?
It's definitely put me in a position sometimes where I question myself a little bit of whether I want to continue down this path. But I'm already here, so I'm kind of like, well, a little too late for that. But I think one of the things I realize is what I need to do to make sure I either like don't get the burnout or have the support around me to deal with everything that we're dealing with right now.
And what does that look like to you? How do you make that happen?
Well, specifically for burnout, I am currently looking into post-graduation programs that have like support, whether that be a preceptor for new grad nurses or mentors for those programs, because once I enter the workforce as a new nurse, like I'm transitioning from being a student nurse to a registered nurse, and that's going to take some adjusting to. And I've heard that the first 2 years are difficult. So I'm looking for programs that have the support for the students, and it's a continuous support, because that's one of the most important things to not have burnout, at least in my opinion.
Well, as you've already said, you decided to do this line of work long before a pandemic broke out. But now that you're seeing what's happening out there, like, were you prepared or did you realize like how dangerous the work could be, and the fact that, you know, many nurses out there are putting their lives at risk? And does that make you reconsider at all?
I definitely didn't realize the extent of the risk, because I'm interested in like labor and delivery nursing and pediatric nursing. So compared to a lot of other areas of nursing, my specific interests are not as high risk, we'll say. But now that I'm seeing the risk that I might be into, yes, I was a little hesitant at first, but it's one of the things that I'm thinking about, like, only nurses can do this. Only nurses can take this risk. And so that's just something I have to keep reminding myself of. And I'm scared, but I'm willing to do it.
Yeah. How are your nursing professors handling this? In other words, are they talking to you about it? Is it a topic of discussion in class?
It's been a topic of class since even January, when things were still not even in the United States. Like, one of my classes, we were literally following the pandemic and talking about how it could affect us. And then when it did in March, every single one of my classes, nursing or not, if you were a nursing major, you got asked a question about how you were feeling, especially being like junior and senior nurses, of what does this mean for us going into the workforce or about to go into the workforce? So if you're a nursing major, you've definitely been talking about this.
I bet you are. And you are a senior. So what are your plans? What do you expect to be doing when you get out there? And I hate to say the real world, but the real world's kind of scary right now.
Definitely valid. I'm laughing because even I say that to myself, like, real world is a little bit scarier than it was before. Truly, I don't know. I don't know what may... Here's the thing, is we don't know what tomorrow will look like, let alone me to think about what May, when I am hopefully going to graduate, looks like. So I think what's going to end up happening is I'm going to probably be on some kind of hospital, either on a COVID unit or a medical surgical unit, or just trying to give an extra set of hands to whatever the situation looks like by that point in time.
Well, Tanya, the good news may be that by the time you get there, a vaccine will be in place, and that's what we have to cross our fingers for. Tanya Sannin, a senior at Villanova's Fitzpatrick College of Nursing, good luck to you out there, and thanks very much for speaking with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. For more than a century, a resilient city and region have relied on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve our most serious problems. The Foundation's work has been strengthened by hundreds of people who've left legacies to support our community. Leaving a charitable legacy at the Boston Foundation is a great way to have an impact now and in the future. Learn more at tbf.org/partner.
Warner Brothers has announced it will release all its movies next year to theaters and to HBO Max simultaneously. Warner Brothers and the streaming service HBO Max are owned by the same company. It says this is a temporary decision due to the pandemic, but it took theater chains by surprise, and some industry experts think it may signal a huge change in the movie industry. We're joined now by Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Lisa.
Is that huge change theaters are worried about simply that the pandemic will make them defunct?
Yeah, and I think it's a continuum, because there was already a move toward this even pre-pandemic. There was an idea that movie theaters, movie companies had started to release things simultaneously or near simultaneously to streaming. This isn't the first time things will be released right to streaming. But there was a release of a recent movie, Christopher Nolan's spy thriller Tenet, that helped sort of change Warner's mind about theatrical releases. It was the only big budget film to have been released exclusively in theaters during the pandemic. They were expected to earn $800 million to $1 billion. It released on September 3rd, and it's made $57 million in the United States, $300 million worldwide. So, you know, part of that might be that in September we started to take this more seriously and realized it wasn't going away. But part of it is the reality that they don't expect people going to movie theaters anytime soon.
But Warner Brothers had a previous plan, and that was to release just one film to theaters and HBO Max at the same time. And that was Wonder Woman 1984. But now it wants to release all of them, all 17 that were slated for 2021. So what happened?
Well, I think the fact that it was so poorly received, the last one that they put into theaters, and the fact that there's just no reality about when theaters are going to be open. Most theaters are closed right now, and they may not open until spring or summer of next year. Meanwhile, movie production has continued. People have moved into a method of movie production that is relatively COVID safe, going into filming in areas that are easier to shoot in. So there are still movies coming out. There's still remarkable demand for movies in TV, and that demand just isn't happening in theaters.
So Warner and HBO Max are owned by the same company, as we said. Is this decision as basic as let's prioritize the streaming service that we sort of own and let the theaters that we don't own take care of themselves?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of that. I think it's, the Warner model in particular is making a little bit of a concession to theaters. So movies will be released on the same day, but new movies will disappear from HBO Max 1 month after they're released, and they'll still remain in theaters. So for whatever reason, you're not an early adopter to a particular film and you want to see it after a month, assuming a theater is open, which is a big assumption right now, you'll see it in the theater after a month. Other studios are making similar pivots. Universal struck a deal with Cinemark theaters to make movies available on demand 17 days after theatrical release. So movies have a 17-day head start. So it's unclear where this is going and how much of it will be affected once theaters open versus how much of this is just going to be an almost permanent change.
And we know the head of AMC Entertainment, the largest chain of theaters, has already reached out to Warner for urgent discussions. We'll see where they go and talk to you about it as well. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks, Lisa.
President-elect Joe Biden says Dr. Anthony Fauci will continue to play a lead role in the nation's pandemic response as White House chief medical advisor. And even though vaccine breakthroughs mean the end may be in sight, the coronavirus rages on. In rural America, treating COVID-19 patients can be especially difficult. People live far from limited medical facilities, and communities are small and isolated. Often, there's a stigma around just getting tested for the virus. Joey Trawick is a registered nurse working in the COVID-19 unit at St. Vincent Healthcare in Billings, Montana. Joey, could you tell us a bit about the situation you face inside St. Vincent right now?
You know, it's sort of an ominous feeling because as you're coming up the hospital elevators or up the stairs, you're seeing signs, do not enter, restricted access. You start realizing you're kind of going into the heart of the beast, if you will, and that last entry, that last door that you come in through, you already have a surgical mask on, obviously, because you can't come into the hospital without one. But the first place that you go to is to go get your N95 and your face shield. And you make your way immediately to, you know, the nurse that needs to leave that's already been there for 12 hours or more. And you're putting on PPE as you're talking outside the patient room. You're putting on a gown. They're trying to tell you this is the status. This is what we experienced last night. And as you're having this conversation with one person, another nurse is waiting for your attention that had a different patient down the hall. So you're trying to get this conversation rolling and understanding what you need to do for this patient right now. And there's another patient in the room next door that also needs you right now. And it's not just one or two patients, three and four and five patients that need you right now.
And this is not even the ICU. This is in the regular COVID unit.
That's right. And unfortunately, Lisa, in a rural environment, there's only so many rooms in the ICU. And so you almost have to bargain with the ICU and the family and the patient to say, you know, how do we get you where you need to be? How do we get you the level of care that you need? And I'll take your patient out of the ICU if you'll take my patient on the COVID floor into the ICU. And so give me your healthiest patient in the ICU, and I'll give you my sickest patient on the COVID unit.
And this is all because of so few rooms available, nurses and doctors to take care of the patients?
Exactly. As much as we would, I mean, we do the best we can. You know, we're rural medicine, 500 miles for any direction. We're it. We have more cows than people in Montana, we like to say. You know, and we take pride in the fact that we're sort of isolated and independent and all those things. But it doesn't take long to see that if we continue to have this exponential growth, we're going to continue to have to ship patients to Denver or Salt Lake City.
You, I understand, are recovering from COVID-19. What were your symptoms, and were you ever hospitalized yourself?
I wasn't hospitalized, but I was down. In fact, I'm still not 100%. Like I said, when you come to the COVID unit, they want you to be at 120%. You hit the ground running. I still feel like I'm operating at 75 or 80%. Even the shower hurt, like standing in the shower, the water hitting my skin. I was shivering in chills, but in a hot shower. Physicians reached out, fellow nurses reached out, you know, and they said, you know, any moment that you don't feel up to it, you don't have to come back. Just take your time. But then in the back of your mind, you're thinking, you know, my patients and their families are suffering. And here I am. I need to get better. I don't really have time to meander or wallow, if you will, in this. I need to get back. And it's kind of weird. I think it's how it's going to define us as a generation of caregivers, of nurses.
Could you tell us about your care for a particular patient in the past few days or week?
I had a young man that came to me from the Northern Cheyenne tribe. His name was J.D., Old Mouse. And he was my age, late 40s. And he and I did not get along at first because he wanted things to be precise and on time. And, you know, I kept telling him we're, you know, super stressed. He was the last flute maker for the Northern Cheyenne people. Mm-hmm. And he and I ended up getting along after several weeks of interacting. And I think I was doing a stretch of 14, 15 shifts in a row. So I had him every day. It wasn't going well. His condition kept deteriorating. And he and I had a conversation before he went down to the ICU. And I said, you know, you're going to get better. He said, no, I don't know that I'm going to make it. And I said, you owe me a flute. You said you were going to make me a flute and teach me how to play it. And he kind of smiled and said, all right, I'll get you a flute. And 2 days later, after he went to the ICU, he passed. And his family actually called me that night and said, Joey, we would like to thank you. And I went to the parking lot of our emergency department, and there were 40 friends and family from the Northern Cheyenne tribe that encircled me and prayed for me in the dark at 9 o'clock at night to thank me. And then they just said, you know, we have to go. We can't stay here because they're escorting his body from the hospital to the funeral home. And I'm just standing there in the dark thinking, what just happened? And a little while later, I got from a total stranger in Arizona a handmade Native American flute called the Sparrowhawk. This guy had just seen and heard of all the things we were going through here in Montana. And he said, I had this flute. Someone gave it to me. I haven't ever played it. It crossed my mind that someday I would give it away. And you crossed my mind. I saw your story and I thought, I know where to send this flute. And I'm looking at it right now. It's in my hands. And I think, you know, if we're waiting for the other half of the country to develop an empathetic response or dramatically change to having compassion for their neighbor, if we're waiting for that, I don't know that we're going to make it. So my job is to have twice as much compassion and twice as much empathy for the people that don't have it and the people that don't think about wearing a mask, for my friend J.D. Old Mouse, right? That is my responsibility and the responsibility of all of us on the front lines, that we are tenderly, compassionately having to double the amount of compassion and forethought and respect for those lives that we're taking care of, the people that we're seeing that are passing.
You're saying that knowing that the illness is so random and so unjust, but I'm wondering if, Joey, you've been able to find moments of solace in all of this. What are you doing to get through?
I mean, I literally have been sitting here filling out thank you cards for people that have sent kind notes and gifts. And one lady painted a picture. She's 80 years old. She lives in Santa Clarita, California. And she said, I can't go out and buy a card, but I painted this watercolor by hand. And it says, for the last responders.
Well, it's good to speak with you. We're glad you're feeling better and hope you continue your recovery. Joey Trawick, a registered nurse with St. Vincent Healthcare in Billings, Montana, on the road to recovery from having COVID-19 and still on the job. Joey, thank you so much. Good luck.
Thank you, Lisa.
We're wondering if you've been the recipient of somebody's act of kindness in this especially tough year. With the holidays approaching, we're collecting stories of good deeds. So tell us your story of receiving an act of kindness or performing one, large or small, and what kind of difference it made in your life. Let us know at hereandnow.org. You can also email us at letters@hereandnow.org.
Did you know that in Iceland, there's a tradition of exchanging books as presents on Christmas Eve? It's called the Christmas Book Flood, and Icelanders spend the night reading their gifts. Well, if that sounds good to you and you're thinking of giving books this holiday season, we've got the person for you. Petra Mayer of NPR Books joins us now with a few ideas. Petra, it must be the holidays. We're talking. Welcome.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you again.
You know, I have a friend who swears that in the pandemic, because of the pandemic, he's actually doing much less reading. He just can't focus. But what are you seeing? Are there more people out there reading because they're spending more time at home?
Oh, I totally feel for your friend. For the first couple of months of the pandemic, I could not read a book. And when something finally flipped in my head and I could again, I truly, literally felt as if cool rain was falling inside my skull. So I have all the sympathy for people who can't read right now. That being said, book sales are up this year. People are reading a lot. So there's an industry analyst group called NPD, and I'm looking at their report for the third quarter of 2020. And according to them, year-to-date book sales grew more than 6% through that quarter. So apparently that's the highest third quarter growth since Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince in 2005.
Oh, wow.
And that's not even reflecting holiday shopping. And also, big surprise, politics and current events books drove a lot of that sales increase. And kids' books are also up. I guess if you're stuck inside with kids all summer, that makes sense.
No doubt. Well, I guess my friend was an anomaly, which I would believe.
No, anyways, your friend is not alone. There's a lot of people.
I'll let him know. Let's talk about some of your picks, starting with the novel, The Death of Vivek Auggie. What made you want to suggest this one?
Oh, this is a wonderful and really hard to categorize and beautiful book. So obviously not a spoiler to say that the main character dies right at the beginning. It's in the title. It's a mystery because, you know, his mother finds his body on the front stoop right at the beginning of the book, and the grief drives her to figure out how he died. But it's also a coming-of-age story and a coming-out story because Vivek, I mean, I'm referring to him as he, but Vivek is non-binary, just like the author, Akweke Emeze, actually. So in the book, he asks his friends to call him either he or she because he's both. And at one point he says, "I'm not what anyone thinks I am. I never was." And there's also all kinds of Nigerian folklore and mythology woven into the story. And it's also just gorgeously written. So hard to categorize like Vivek Auggie himself, but a really great read.
Sounds interesting and also timely. You have a pick for people who love to read about food, Bill Buford's Dirt. This is the guy that wrote the best-selling book Heat about working in a restaurant kitchen. What's this new one about?
So this, I have to say, may slightly make you hate Bill Buford because even, you know, before our world turned upside down, I don't think many of us could decide, oh, I want to master French cooking, but working for the best fresh chefs in America isn't enough. So I'm just going to uproot my entire family and move them to France. But that's what he does. He takes them to Lyon, which he thinks of as kind of the epicenter of French cooking. But the book is, it's as much about his journey towards mastering French cooking as much as an American can, as it is about the history and the gastronomic history of the city. And it's also just full of really great characters. At one point, he apprentices with a bread maker named Bob, who he describes as looking like a cross between... Yeah, well, Bob's not his real name. I don't think we ever find out what his real name is. But he describes him as looking like a cross between Fred Flintstone and Jackie Gleason. So it's a really fun read. Just don't do what I did and read it and then like end up on the Williams-Sonoma or Sur La Table website. That's bad.
Yeah. Another book that people might be interested in is Molly Young's The Things They Fancy. But actually, it's not a book exactly.
No, it's a zine. So it's a deep dive into frivolous aristocratic fads throughout the ages. There's a chapter on pineapples. If you read any Regency novels, you know pineapples were a big thing in the early 19th century. But did you know that squirrels were once a fashionable upper-class pet. I didn't. And apparently, because they're so little and cute, they were, they were considered good pets for women. People would put little gold collars on them. We have a tag in the concierge called It's All Geek to Me, which is exactly for this kind of thing. These, like, obsessive examinations of things you would never have thought of otherwise.
Yeah. Okay, Petra, a book on your list that I want you to talk about is We Are Water Protectors by Carol Lindstrom. This is something that is interesting for me as a parent because it's a kid's book and it addresses oil pipelines being built on native lands. I mean, a lot of parents are always looking for books that can actually help their kids learn something. So tell us more about this one.
Yeah, this book is just gorgeous. Like, this is a book where we all went, ooh. So the author and the illustrator, they're both Native American. The author directly said she was inspired by the Standing Rock protests. And she says in the book, in fact, that she couldn't travel to the protests, so she decided to create this book, which is about a little girl sort of learning about the importance of water and her role in protecting water. In the book, the oil pipelines are represented by a evil black snake, and that she and her people have to band together and fight it. So it's a really uplifting story. I mean, you'll learn something, but hopefully you'll feel inspired. And, you know, who couldn't use that right now?
Yeah, these all sound great, but as you know, we have many discerning listeners, and, you know, maybe what we've talked about here isn't doing it for people quite yet. What should those people do? What's your advice to them in terms of finding a good book gift?
They should go to the book concierge at npr.org/bestbooks. It just went up on Tuesday. Bigger than ever, it has more than 380 books, all picked by our staffers and critics, and surely you will find something there.
Oh, we'll also link to it at hereandnow.org. We've been talking about the best books of the year with Petra Mayer of NPR Books. Thank you very much, and happy holidays to you.
You too. My pleasure. Happy to be here.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now.